In the early hours of April 1st, 1988, two Fairbanks boys broke into a building, stole an automatic pistol, an instruction booklet for the gun, two boxes of ammunition, and some candy. They allegedly discussed robbing a convenience store, but decided instead they would rob and then kill a cab driver. Before the night was out, they flagged down a cab which drove them to McGrath Road. One of the boys shot the driver four times in the back, even as he was trying to throw a wad of money to them. They pulled him out of the cab and shot him again in the head. The two, 16 and 17 years old, then walked to a Second Avenue arcade where they traded the gun for cocaine. They were arrested 2 days later. In 1986, a Barrow youth took an axe, killed one person with three blows to the neck, and crippled another with 16 blows. And in Anchorage, a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old accomplice robbed and executed three elderly people. At 14, the girl already had a history of burglary, drug use, and prostitution. These people are, or were at the time of their violent acts, children, adolescents. Yet the crimes they committed are the crimes of adults. How does the criminal justice system view and treat them? Today, it's on Sunday at noon, we look at how the juvenile waiver process forms a bridge between the juvenile justice and adult criminal justice systems, and how and when it decides that a child must be tried and sentenced as an adult. I'm Susan McInnes. My guest today, Assistant District Attorney Mark Wood and Assistant Public Defender Christine Smith. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for joining us today on Sunday at noon. I want to begin with where the two systems diverge, how they are different. Can we look at first differences between the adult criminal justice system and the juvenile system so that our audience can get a grasp of how adults and youths are treated? Christine Smith, sure. Perhaps we'll begin with the juvenile system.
Sure. The difference essentially is a difference in goals. In the juvenile justice system, the goal is rehabilitation, and it's just pure treatment and trying to get a kid to turn his or her life around and become a productive citizen. And the goal in the adult system is more punishment, deterrence, things that society is more interested in controlling. Perhaps Mark could speak to that. But for juveniles, the only focus of treatment or handling kids is treatment and rehabilitation.
A major difference is that the juvenile justice system is time limited. In an adult correction system, there may be a lifetime to effect or receive punishment. In the juvenile system, it's not so.
That's right. As soon as a kid turns the age of 19, that system is essentially over for that kid. Unless the kid consents to treatment until the age of 20, that is the longest that the juvenile system can have any control over a kid.
And Mark Wood, the adult system, basically based on punishment?
Under our Constitution, the adult system is based on both a protection of society and the reformation of the offender. Those are the two constitutional goals. But the procedures and the concerns are different, where In the adult system, for a felony such as the ones that you discussed in the opening statement, you know, we go to the grand jury. The grand jury decides whether there's sufficient evidence to charge a crime. Then the person is brought before the superior court. Dates are set for an omnibus hearing and for trial. You take care of determining whether the person is guilty or not guilty of the crime, and then you go to the sentencing stage. Whereas in the juvenile system, even though it starts with a petition, and I'm just talking about a normal juvenile case, not a waiver case, it'll start with a petition, and there's concern about determining whether the child did it or not prior to disposition. Almost from the beginning, the major concern is, what are we going to do with this kid? How are we going to help solve this kid's problems, assuming that he has a problem? In much of the discussion between, for instance, Christine and the Attorney General's office, which handles the non-waiver juvenile cases, involves disposition even prior to adjudication of guilt or innocence.
And this concern with the outcome at the outset, from the beginning, is a concern of the last 120 years or so when the juvenile system was formed, right? Was it separated off from the adult criminal justice system?
I haven't just sat down and studied the history. I remember reading some things when I was going to law school that somewhere in the latter part of the 19th century, I think Christine was mentioning earlier, in the 1870s or so, a couple of states decided to treat juveniles differently and separate them from the adult system on the theory that because juveniles are in a changing period of their life, adolescence is a very fast-moving, changing period of life, that there's more likelihood that if you catch them early after they've started criminal behavior, that you can change that any tendency they might have to an adult life of crime by treating them and treating the problems that they have. And therefore, they developed a kind of a treatment model to focus on rehabilitation of juvenile offenders.
And this model represents the sense that children are plastic, still forming, but also that they're not fully responsible. Is that so?
That's right. They're not treated as fully responsible for their acts because they're seen as having not the same judgment as an adult has. They are more impulsive. They're less responsible in their acts. I think, everyone can see that in junior high and high school kids. Everyone expects that during those years, kids will be gaining the judgment and the control, impulse control, that they're going to need as adults. But that process of gaining it is a flexible process. And some kids it takes longer, some kids not so long.
In the case of the violent crimes, for example, that I described at the beginning of this program, these children are really thwarting the system in some ways, aren't they? The juvenile system, in as much as they're committing crimes for which we think people are very much responsible. That if you murder someone, it's not something that, like a youthful prank, it's not misbehaving. It's something that the society takes very seriously. So it's a different...
Well, when you say they're thwarting the system, I'm not sure they even know what the system mm-hmm. is, or that they even think that far ahead as to what could happen to me. I think a lot of kids feel nothing's going to happen to them because perhaps nothing has happened to them already. They may have a long series of criminal acts, delinquent acts, that have never been detected before or have been protected within the family. I believe there are case studies and research studies that show that one of the inhibitors on violence is some kind of a juvenile system or a strong set of parents or school system that really hold a kid down and check their impulses. And I think the probation system the kids would normally be under when they commit a juvenile delinquent act, that acts as some kind of a safeguard. So I think sometimes we see kids who act out really violent ways and have not already been part of the juvenile delinquency system, and so they don't know what might happen to them. I think a lot of them fully believe that they're going to end up in jail if they commit a criminal act. And I know my clients, when they come into my office for doing even something as nonviolent as shoplifting, often feel, they ask me, how long am I going to be in jail?
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing that at that stage and at their young age, detention or a jail-like facility is not an option. So I don't think kids plan far enough in advance when they go to commit a serious crime.
What do you think the impact on your kids is when they find out that, hey, I'm not going to jail, I'm just going to be on probation, or they're going to slap my hand and turn me away, or be in some sort of either informal probation or probation where they have to meet with their counselors? Does that tend to make them feel as if, maybe I can continue in this behavior because I'm not mm-hmm. getting any consequences?
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it does. Sometimes, though, kids are very frightened by the process of having to go in and face a judge and actually admit what they've done and go through the probationary process. But there are kids who do not ever go to the detention facility, even for a couple of days, who never are institutionalized, and when they first are caught or apprehended, do feel like, well, nothing happened to me. I got mm-hmm. a slap on the wrist. But if they continue, they eventually end up in court more and more often, And many of those kids just follow some kind of a pattern that ends up with their removal from the home, either into a group home or, you know, the locked facility like FYF or McLaughlin.
You know, I think it would be really helpful. I don't think most people know what the juvenile system is in terms of the alternatives that are available and what happens after a petition is filed. Even before we get to the waiver issue, I think it would just be helpful. Maybe Christine explain that.
That was my next question. So we're doing fine.
How does it happen?
Yeah.
Okay. Once a delinquent act is committed and a child is caught, the probation officer will look at the police report that's filed and write a petition which describes the charge and then ask for a court hearing in that petition. Child gets a copy of the petition and is entitled at that point to have a lawyer. That would be where I would be called in, and I would talk with the child and say at the petition hearing, you either admit or deny the charge. If you admit the charge, there will be no trial, and the next hearing will be like your sentencing, and that's called the disposition that Mark mentioned earlier. If the child denies the petition, the child is entitled to a trial with a jury on the charges. And if found guilty by a jury, will go to that same disposition or sentencing. If found not guilty on all of the charges, then the child is out of the system. The probation officers, I'd say 99% of the time, file charges that they can prove. And most kids do not want to have a trial. They are scared and they want to admit the charge and go right to disposition, and they want to find out immediately what's going to happen to them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because of administrative pressures and so forth, the petition hearing and the disposition are usually separated by 6 or 7 weeks. And during that time, the child is in limbo, not exactly knowing what's going to happen, but knowing that they've been in court once, they're going to have to go back again, and a judge is going to make a decision. At disposition, the court can choose several alternatives that will meet this child's needs. And the probation officer will write a recommendation based upon what he or she knows of the child. And then the court will choose an appropriate disposition and give the kid a chance to try to see how he or she will do during that period of time. The court is mandated by our Supreme Court to choose the least restrictive alternative wherein that child can be rehabilitated.
And some examples of those?
The first choice, then, would be to have the child in the parent's home and have the parents supervising the child and have just a probation officer supervising the kid on a weekly or biweekly basis, bimonthly basis. Or the child can be taken out of the home, placed in state custody, and placed in a foster home or in a group home, and we have several group homes here in Fairbanks. Also in many small communities and in Anchorage, we have group homes that are available to Fairbanks kids.
And these are not staffed by official people. These are staffed by parents.
The foster homes are staffed by parents mm-hmm. or foster parents who are trained to handle problem children. The group homes require a little bit more training, and many of them follow the family teaching model, which puts a kid back in some sort of a family system, because eventually these kids will probably have their own families, and it's nice to believe that they might have functional, healthy families themselves. The most restrictive alternative that is available to the court system is a locked facility like McLaughlin in Anchorage, the Fairbanks Youth Facility here in Fairbanks. FYF has two programs, one that's co-ed and one that's for boys. I believe Nome and Bethel also have locked facilities now. Okay. So that's the range of alternatives for the court. And the court can use any combination of those. You know, if the kid doesn't work out at a group home, he can be placed under a suspended institutional order so that the next step would be an institution.
And there are rehabilitative services offered, therapeutic services offered at the group homes and at the locked facilities?
Yes. Almost all of these kids are in some sort of counseling, either group counseling for their treatment issues or individual counseling. Psychologists are available, people with master's degrees, variously trained staff depending on what the problems are that the child presents.
Yeah. They've made an effort to, for instance, at both McLaughlin and the Fairbanks Youth Facility to train the staff in sexual offender treatment, in a sexual offender treatment modality. And Also, they have a group that deals with substance abuse and alcohol problems, mm-hmm. and they try to work on children of alcoholic parents and the issues that arise out of that. But there is not, even though there's psychotherapists available, there's no one-on-one psychotherapy to speak of in the system.
Not in the youth facilities, but at every other level, when a kid is just at home or yes. in a foster home or group home, those kids will often be seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Yes.
Now, the juvenile waiver process forms a bridge between juvenile corrections and adult corrections. When a child has committed a violent and heinous crime, or I understand when a persistent criminal behavior has just reached almost the bursting point. Is that accurate? And what kinds of crimes or persistent behaviors can bring a child to the juvenile waiver process, either of you?
Basically unclassified felonies, murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree. I suppose if we had a heinous kidnapping, we've considered it, and I've seen it done on a burglary, sexual assault in the first degree type of case. Crimes of violence generally are the things that lead into waiver. Although there have been waivers, for instance, a juvenile who has persistently violated the law over a period of time and has had experience with the system, at least up to the group home level, who continues to violate the law and is now 17 years of age or just under 18 years of age. That young person is likely the state will attempt to waive that person to adult status, saying, we've tried just about everything that we have, and mm-hmm. we can't rehabilitate him within the time remaining in the system, which is 20 years of age. One of the things we didn't mention earlier, at age 20, when you get into the situation of treatment, at age 20, whether they've completed their program or the treatment or not, they're cut loose. I mean, we have no statutory jurisdiction or authority. His 20th birthday comes, and we just have to open the door and let him out. There's no way to monitor him on probation or supervise probation or to follow up his activities, require him to continue in treatment, to involve him in any halfway houses or gradual entering back into the community. He is out of the system, and he's not in the adult system. He walks out the door at age 20.
There's no blend of the systems at that.
There is no blend in the systems, period.
Some states, though, are moving toward that, recognizing that it's just not working. You know, the waiver system is designed as a safety valve that everyone, I believe, recognizes that there are some people, some juveniles, that will not benefit from whatever treatment is available before their 20th birthday. And the system is designed to try to screen out those kids mm-hmm. and put them into the adult criminal system. And at the same time, keep the ones who are amenable to treatment and will benefit from what the system has to offer within the juvenile system. But there are some that are very close cases. Mm-hmm. And if you err on the liberal side and you keep a child in the juvenile system and the child really hasn't received enough treatment or has not been amenable, like first thought, at age 20, there is nothing there. And some states are moving to extend that to age 25 or to put a child in treatment first and then evaluate at age 20 to see if they should go into the adult system or remain as juveniles. But Alaska's law doesn't allow that right now. Right now it's a very cold choice, waiver to the adult system or remain in the juvenile system and be released at age 20.
And the choice to waive is, as I understand it, the exception rather than the rule. This is, as you said, Mark, where the system tries to do everything it can with this juvenile before it will make the decision to waive.
Well, I think that's a theory, but I think for practical purposes, when you have a serious crime like any of the three which you mentioned there, the likelihood that a 16 or 17-year-old will not be waived to the adult system for committing murder in the first degree is very low likelihood. And others are going to be waived for the most part in those types of cases. I don't know if Christine would agree with me on that, but
I would agree. I think it's at some point a political decision rather than a treatment decision. These crimes shock society. Mm-hmm. They're outrageous. And the thought of keeping someone in a closed facility for treatment for 2 years or 3 years and then releasing them.
After having murdered three elderly people, for example, the 14-year-old in Anchorage.
Yeah. It just goes against the grain of the community. And any judge that would keep a juvenile in the juvenile system, no matter how good the prospects are for treatment, that judge has to face re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true throughout the country, that judges, they feel that pressure from the community to see that justice is done and justice is getting more punishment-oriented.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Assistant District Attorney Mark Wood and Assistant Public Defender Christine Smith, two people who have a great deal of experience working with the juvenile waiver process when a child commits a crime of such magnitude that the juvenile system is not able to deal with that child effectively. Did you have a comment before we went on?
I was going to say that it might be helpful to just talk about how the whole waiver system works.
My next question.
In the procedure. I'm sorry, maybe I'm anticipating, but...
working with an attorney, you're trained to anticipate.
Just like with the regular juvenile system, the waiver system starts with a petition, except it's not a petition that the minor has committed these acts. It's a petition that the minor has committed these acts and that the minor is not amenable to treatment within the juvenile system, and therefore jurisdiction over the minor from the juvenile court should be closed and he should be treated as an adult. What happens after a petition is filed, most of these minors are detained, meaning that their crimes which they've committed are serious. They're considered a dangerous to society or a flight risk. As a result of that, they're locked up in the local juvenile facility with other juveniles, and proceedings start. It doesn't have to be a two-part proceeding, but most of the courts treat it as a two-part proceeding. There's two things that have to occur. One, the state must come in with its evidence and subjected to cross-examination by the defense attorney and establish that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed and that the juvenile committed the crime. This is just like a preliminary hearing for the adult system.
Mm-hmm.
The same rules apply. But there's a second part of the hearing, and this is the one that usually takes most of the time. For instance, I was involved in the first two of those instances, and Christine was involved in one of them. The probable cause hearing was, I think, 3 or 4 days for the Barrow case, but only one day. For the Fairbanks case involving the two young men who committed the armed robbery and the resulting murder. However, then we set up a time to determine the issue of whether he is amenable to treatment. And the way the statute phrases it is whether or not he can probably be rehabilitated by his 20th birthday. There's no statutory definition for rehabilitation, but there's four factors that need to be considered: the seriousness of the present offense, the minor's past history of delinquency and other criminal behavior, the probable cause of the delinquent behavior, where we spend a lot of time on, and the facilities available to treat the minor and essentially solve those problems by the time that he reaches 20.
And the probable cause of the delinquent behavior is, again, a pointer towards whether the child can be rehabilitated or not. Was he raised in a dysfunctional alcoholic family, violence in the home, those kinds of questions enter in?
Well, yeah, what the Supreme Court has said is that there has to be a thorough examination of the minor's background, and the judge has to very carefully make a determination as to what he believes caused the criminal behavior. While frequently psychotherapists are called upon to evaluate the minor and to render opinions, the Court of Appeals has said that you don't have to make the decision based upon expert testimony, as long as you've given a thorough investigation of the child's background and the nature of the crime and what was happening in this particular instance.
As we go along, we're going to be looking at, I suppose, how well the system works and its flaws. It seems to me that this is a tremendous burden to place on a judge to determine whether a child will be, any person will be amenable to treatment within X period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Christine?
I think it is, especially when you have a child who has no treatment history, a child who may never have been in counseling before or under supervised probation. I think it's very difficult for a judge to take a look at this kid who now is remorseful, who is showing some improvement perhaps while being detained, whose family is starting to pull together and support the child. But you don't know what's going to happen in the future, and it's very difficult for even psychiatrists and psychologists to determine future dangerousness. I would say it places a tremendous burden on a judge.
In fact, if you will, in cross-examination, we talk to the psychotherapists, evaluate these kids, and they're trying to make their best guess as to whether they can work with this kid in treatment. But all of them will say, when you put them down to the task, that no, we cannot predict future behavior. If you're going to predict future behavior, the past is the best indication of the future in terms of the behavior. All we can tell is whether we can work with this kid or not, and that's basically what the discussion. We spent days on this. I think on one of the co-defendants on this, on Robert. I think we were 5 days, and then several other hearings afterwards. It worked out to about 8 days worth of hearings, just on the issue of. Is the kid amenable or not? And the co-defendant was 3 or 4 days.
And one of the factors that became very important and will be in the future is the issue of facilities available to treat kids. Like Mark mentioned earlier, although there is a staff psychologist at FYF and also at McLaughlin, these people are there for consulting. They're not there for one-on-one counseling with kids. And as long as the facilities do not have the kind of psychological expertise that psychologists on the stand say that a kid needs, there won't be facilities available to meet the kid's needs. So it's not only do you have to have a kid who can benefit from treatment, you also have to have treatment which will help the kid. And that treatment is often from private hospitals or private clinics, and it's very expensive. And I think that comes down again to another, not a political decision perhaps, but an economic decision. How much is it worth to pay for treatment for a kid, for a treatment that may be uncertain because we don't know if it's going to work or not?
If it's determined that the treatment needs are high and the facilities services are low relative to those treatment needs, Is the judge able then to stop and say, okay, what kinds of treatment facilities might be available through adult corrections?
The judge is not allowed to make the decision as to where the minor can best be treated. In other words, he can't say that he could be treated better in the adult system, and therefore I'm going to waive him to the adult system. That's not within his scope. He has to decide on the treatment facilities available in the juvenile system to meet his problems.
That's a tremendous irony.
Well, not really, because, frankly, the treatment available in the adult system probably can't meet his needs either.
I don't think there is any treatment.
The only thing that is really good in the adult system in terms of the state of the art, and we don't even know if that's good, and that's the sexual offender treatment programs that exist in a couple of the couple of the institutions. In Alaska, they've developed those to the point where they're at the cutting edge of treatment. But whether that solves the problems of a sexual offender, who knows? Nowhere in the state, for instance, I mean, one of the common problems in both the adult and the juvenile system is substance abuse. In the juvenile system, they have some certified substance abuse counselors who work with the kids one-on-one and try to do groups. And in the adult system, they have a little more sophisticated program, and there is access to some residential treatment programs. But we don't have any sophisticated residential alcohol treatment program for minors in the state.
Yes, we do.
Christine?
It's sophisticated?
I think we do. We've got ARCH. Are you familiar
with
the ARCH program?
Well, yeah, but they're not locked facilities.
Well, no, they're not locked, but they are residential facilities with really qualified staff dealing with just the problem of alcoholism, drug dependency.
No, I'm talking about the institution-based institution-based program. Okay, so I stand corrected with respect to the private homes, and I don't want to get on their bad list. But in the institution, we don't have a place where a kid's committed a serious crime. He's got a terrible substance abuse problem, and most of these kids have some sort of substance abuse problem, where we can give them residential, the full course of substance abuse treatment before turning them over to the behavior mod programs that are in the institution.
And affect that while they're in a locked situation so that society is protected from them.
That's right.
And their treatment in place at least is assured. I mean, they can't walk away from it.
That's right. I think it would be worth looking at the population that are deemed treatable and are in the Fairbanks Youth Facility or McLaughlin. These are kids that are not just shoplifters. Many of them have done violent acts. Many of them have sexual offenses in their background, either been a victim or a perpetrator. A lot of property crimes, assaults, things like that. And the problems that they bring to the youth facility are varied. There's alcoholism. They've been neglected. There's drug dependency other than alcohol, like even glue sniffing, which is a real serious problem. Being a victim of sexual offenses themselves, and this is boys also, not just girls. Being abandoned by their parents. I've had kids who end up in detention for what we think will be a brief period of time, and parents leave town with no forwarding address. Mm. And this causes a lot of problems for the staff to deal with. So the problems that the staff at FYF do deal with are tremendously complex. And although they're not psychologists, they certainly have a lot of training and hands-on experience with working with kids with serious problems.
Is there a way to gauge how well they do, how well the treatment programs in, say, Fairbanks Youth Facility do with children who are violent or persistent offenders?
Only informally. There are no studies. There's no follow-up.
The juvenile system is kind of a stepchild of the legislature. They give it enough money to function, but they don't give enough money for the niceties of statistical analysis on how they're doing. And even though McLaughlin, for instance, has been in business for 15, 16 years, maybe earlier, 72, I can't remember, early 70s, the only way they've tracked how they've done with their serious offenders is Ralph Morris, who heads the program, has kind of kept an informal basis as to whether these people, if he finds out somehow that a person has been arrested down the road, then he keeps track of that, but he doesn't have a real good statistical follow-up on how we do. And there have only been a few follow-up studies nationwide on tracking juvenile offenders or a group of juveniles who go into the system and how they do later on in life. And so there's really not a good statistical profile of how anybody does in treatment with juveniles.
Again, we're talking to Assistant District Attorney Mark Wood and Assistant Public Defender Christine Smith. Our subject today is the juvenile waiver process when a child commits persistent criminal acts or violent and heinous acts. What does the state do with that child, and how does it treat the individual? Mark Wood, you've criticized the juvenile waiver process itself, the hearing process, for taking such a long time, and one of the bases on which you've criticized it is that the victims, if they still live, or the family and loved ones of these victims really are, their difficulty and their pain is extended by the time it takes for the hearing process. Yeah.
The trauma continues until the matter is resolved in the courts, and they really can't put it behind them until that period of time. I probably need to preface my remarks when you say I've criticized, and yeah, I've made some comments.
Critique.
Criticize is probably an appropriate word. I have some very strong opinions, but they're my opinions. And when I talk about what I think about the system, I'm not talking as a member of the Department of Law or an assistant district attorney. I'm just Mark Wood, lawyer and citizen person who has some opinions about the thing, and I don't want anybody to misconstrue what I say as the official position of the department. Mm-hmm. But let me just give you just some examples. We were talking about the process of the waiver system. Well, to get to the point of waiver, for instance, in this the Barrel case with the axe murder, it took us almost 13 months to complete the decision to waive that kid to adult status.
He has not been tried for the crime.
Oh, no, he has been. It took 23 months before he was finally convicted and sentenced of that particular crime. Now, in that case, there was a retrial because there was a mistrial after 2 weeks of trial in the first instance. So there were some unusual delays, but still, it was almost 2 years. Now, a similar adult, even if there was a mistrial, would have been accomplished within a 10-month period of time, because of the way the system works. Because once we waive them to adult status, then we start all the adult procedures. They're entitled to a grand jury, and so we take it to grand jury, and then they have all the hearings and all the procedures of the adult system come into vogue. It takes usually a serious case with continuances for between 3 and 6 months. It'll come to trial. There's a 120-day rule that after adult felon is charged, he's supposed to be brought to trial within 120 days, but he can waive that. So there's a 4-month period anyway that you're dealing with. Most of the trials are set at about the 3-month level, but in a complex case, it'll get continued, or there's witness problems, and so it might go beyond the 4-month rule with the consent of the defendant.
So in
then after the trial, then you're dealing with the sentencing process, and the sentencing process is a mirror of what happened in the juvenile waiver process. Now, if it's the same judge that's doing it, you can do it in a day or a half day. But that takes time, and to prepare the pre-sentence report and do the investigation, looking at two or three months. In a normal criminal case, it takes from if the man goes to trial or the woman goes to trial, the adult criminal defendant, it's a 7 to 8 month process in a normal criminal case. That's a long time for a victim, but you know that's we kind of tolerate that. But where are we now on the armed robber case?
This is a case of the cab driver who was murdered by two juveniles.
Okay, well, that case is on appeal. One of them is on appeal.
Yeah. The juvenile system is set up so that after the waiver decision, and this is right. I mean, the way our law is set up, this is how it should be. Because it's such a serious decision, the juvenile has a right to appeal the decision, mm-hmm. or the state has a right to petition a waiver decision. Actually, to petition the waiver decision against it. And to let the appellate court decide whether the trial judge made the right decision. Now, they have an expedited appeal process, which sometimes is more expedited than others. The expedited process is probably 60 to 90 days. But, for instance, in one of these cases right now, it's been on appeal since November. And the decision has not come down, and we're getting close to 10, 11 months. Yeah. The other one, the other co-defendant appealed, and it was reversed, and it has to go back into the trial judge to look at the evidence again in another way. So we're going to redo the waiver proceeding, and we're 18 months beyond the crime at this point in time.
And all during that time, this child has not received any treatment.
Yeah.
And so
the child received no treatment.
And all during this time, the victims of the crime and the relatives of the crime are calling me almost on a weekly basis and saying, what's happening in the system?
When is this
going to be over so I can get on with my life? You know, can you tell me anything, what's going on? And all we can say is that, you know, right now it's in the Court of Appeals and we're waiting for their decision, or the judge is going to be setting a new hearing to work on the waiver issue, and it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And I think it does a disservice to the juvenile, and I think it does a disservice because I think it seriously affects the whole process. I mean, in this particular case, there's there's not much is going to happen to the evidence because of both prior hearings and because of the physical evidence that's involved. But in some cases, it could affect the strength of the state's case when it gets to the adult system. And it could both ways. I mean, it could affect some of his defense witnesses, or it could affect some of the prosecution witnesses. And society, I think, has a right to resolve serious crimes in a expeditious manner, so society can heal and get on with the process. But we're just dragging it out. I haven't gone over 2 years yet, but I've gotten into the second year in every single one of these things, just about.
This can't help but be extremely costly in terms of money. Besides, in terms of pain and patience in a person's life,
the Barrow case. He was waived to adult status, so I can use his name. But the Barrow case, the axe murder, we had the waiver hearing took place two different times in Barrow for 3 days, and once in Anchorage for 3 days because of the available witnesses. And so we were all over the state. So we had nine full days on just the issue of waiver. And then we had a two-week trial twice up in Barrow, and pulling witnesses who had, I mean, the police officers, two of the police officers had moved out of state, one in California, one in Florida. We had to bring them up. We had an FBI witness, two FBI witnesses that came up in that particular case, and we brought them up. And it was a very expensive case by the court time alone. And I guess that's what another part of my criticism of the system. I think there's a way that would at least make it a cleaner process, and instead of trying to sentence the juvenile before he's convicted, focus upon the crime first and then the disposition. And I can talk about that now, or I can talk about it later.
Sure. Let's go ahead and take a look at it. Since we're looking at how the system works and some of its flaws, let's take a look at ways you might, or Christine, you might repair some of those flaws.
Well, the obvious repair is to give the kid treatment while they're in detention or while they're at some point in a facility that's locked. I mean, that's the cheapest thing to do if you're looking at the long run. Now, even if this kid is waived to adult status, any of these kids, at some point they're going to be eligible for parole or for some kind of a release. And what is that kid going to be like after being in an adult prison for several years without any treatment? That scares me. But that's something else. I think one of the things Mark would like to see changed is just some legislative changes to make this system meet the needs of everyone. And there's some changes that I think I would agree with, and I would like him to have a chance to go through that, what he would see the ideal process to be.
Yeah. Mark?
I don't agree with the model that's been in existence for years, and that is the treatment model. And the reason why I don't agree with it is because I think what we tend to do is separate the minor from his problems and say, the reason why you're behaving like this, Johnny, is because you've got these problems, and we're going to treat these problems, and then you don't have to worry about your behavior anymore. And I see kids with serious problems in the system. Christine may agree with this. And we spend all this time talking about his problems, and I think that maybe after a while he may believe that, yes, I've got these terrible problems, and the problems are the reason why I act like this. And I just don't agree with that.
I think that's very healthy for a kid to say, I've got problems, because I certainly see a lot of kids and families that come into my office and say, I don't have a problem. The probation officer's got a problem. The police have a problem. I don't have a problem. I'm doing fine. I don't need to finish school. I don't need to get a job. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear a kid that says, well, yeah, I guess alcoholism is a problem in my family, and maybe that has led to some of the things I've done, I think that's very healthy.
I will agree. To the extent that the system educates the minor that he does have some problems that he needs to deal with, the system is working well. But where the system spends so much time on just treating the problem and not dealing with teaching the kid that he has to be accountable for his behavior in spite of his problems, I think that's where I part company with the system.
I don't think
Let's
that
explore
happens.
Accountability then. Christine?
I don't think that happens. I think while a kid is in treatment, let's say a kid is on probation and they're going to counseling, and the counselor is helping them get through that denial of, I don't have any problems, and the kid is recognizing that they do. During that process, this kid may still be committing crimes. Those are not overlooked. They're not skipped or anything. A probation officer will continue to file petitions saying, you have to admit this in court. You are still continuing to have criminal problems, criminal thinking. And I have had petitions for modification of the probation filed on the basis of a kid not participating fully in treatment, not even committing any crimes, but just not participating fully in treatment, and had kids on, once the kid admits, well, yeah, I could have done better, that gives the court grounds to change the probation, to either make the kid go to more counseling, go to a group home, and at one point a kid was institutionalized.
Yeah, but frequently what happens, and I've seen this happen in the system in the days when I was working on a daily basis with the non-waiver kids, is that a kid can postpone the serious consequences by his behavior by kind of just following the system. Sure, I'm on probation, and he keeps having minor glitches, and he'll do a shoplifting here, and he'll do a criminal mischief in the third degree here. You know, take a car, or maybe he'll have a family blow up and hit his mother or something like that. And they'll file petitions, and the judge will come in and say, now this part of your probation isn't working very well, Johnny, and so yeah, you need to change this. And say, oh yes, I'll change this. I'll be good this time, Your Honor. And 3 months later, he does this, and finally, 2 years later, he hasn't been in detention yet, or if he has been in detention, it's just for a short period of time. He hasn't any serious consequences for behavior, and the system, and he goes out and he commits a felony, or he commits a more serious crime, and the system just comes screaming down on him and wants to lock him away. And the institution says, "Oh, but I haven't been to a group home yet. You know, we need to go to we need to go to the group home because the system requires the least restrictive alternative."
Well, wait, Mark, you've said
wherein treatment can take place. So I've seen kids go from a foster home, skipping the group home, and go right into the institution. It happens.
I know. But how many kids will say, "Well, I need treatment now that I'm caught"? When you know, there's lots of kids who have alcohol problems who don't commit crimes. There's lots of adults who have alcohol problems who don't commit crimes, you know. And kids have problems. Adults have problems. We probably have problems right here in this room, and yet we're functional adults and law-abiding members of the community. Why can't we expect children to be law-abiding members of the community? They live in our society. And so I would like a system built upon choice and accountability, rather the waiver system built on choice and accountability. I don't want to modify necessarily the juvenile system as it currently exists. But when we get into the waiver issue, I would like to change it to reflect choice and accountability. I think we can expect teenagers to obey the law. I don't think society can sit by and say, well, after all, he's only an adolescent. An adolescent, of course, commit crimes, and they'll grow out of it. I don't think we need to expect that as society. I think we can expect them to be law-abiding citizens, and we should impose those expectations.
And Mark, how does that translate? When you say choice and accountability, what then would the system do?
We would start, instead of starting with a waiver petition, when a minor commits a serious crime, let's say it's a Class A or unclassified felonies, the system would start with the state taking the case to a secret grand jury, where the name of the minor would not be released from the grand jury. We started just like the adult process.
Just like adult process.
Right from the beginning. He would be arraigned in a juvenile court to preserve the confidentiality, and we would worry about whether he did the act or not. We'll just start treating him like that. Now, he's housed all the time. Assuming he's detained, he would be housed in a juvenile facility. We want to keep the minors separate from adults. I think that's a good principle, and that should occur until they're age 21 or 22. Anyway, at least keep him in a separate system, and then we're going to just take it. He has 120 day rule to go to trial. We'll go to the if he wants to go to trial, we'll go to trial within 120 days, assuming that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. We'll convict him. And then in the normal process, we're going to set up a disposition hearing. And at the disposition hearing, the judge is going to have at least three alternatives, maybe more. I haven't thought this through. Alternative number one, this young man, regardless of the crime that he's committed, I'm assuming it's a young man because most of them are. there are young women who commit crimes, but there's more young men. This young person has committed a heinous crime, but yes, we do have, you know, there's elements in his personality. We can treat him and we can take care of him by the time he's 20 or 21. And so we're going to keep him in the juvenile system and we're going to provide him treatment.
So that's first alternative.
That's
treatment.
Choice number one. Yeah. Choice number two is what we see in waiver hearings is there are some kids that are just really clearly don't belong in the juvenile system, you know, because of either the maturity or their callousness. And we can't do anything with them anyway. And so the judge will say, this kid's going to the adult system. I'm sentencing you as an adult right now.
Where there may or may not be treatment, but it doesn't matter. You have committed adult crimes.
Just because, you know, maybe he's an antisocial personality, which isn't really, you have to kind of grow out of anyway. And so he should be treatable. He should be treated as an adult and sentenced as an adult. Where the tough kids are in our current system, and where Christine and I agree, are the older kids, 16, 17-year-olds, which show some signs of being able to be, I don't want to use the word amenable to treatment because that's the legal catchword, but they have aspects of their personality and being which would respond to working on their problems, and they might get rehabilitated. You know, that possibility exists. Whether it's a probability is certainly subject to debate, but there's that possibility. I think society needs to place the burden on the right person to make sure that gets accomplished. And the way I would propose for those kids is the judge would say, Johnny, look, I think that you've got some characteristics that tell me that if you want to, you can be rehabilitated. And so here's what we're going to do. Until I'm going to sentence you as an adult, here's your adult sentence. Say it's a murder in the second degree. You're going to jail for 20 years. But I'm keeping you in the juvenile justice system until you're age 21. And you're going to have this treatment that's available, and here's what I want you to work on. You come back to me at age 21, and we'll have a review hearing. And at that review hearing, we're going to see how well you've done. If you've done well, then I'm going to put you on adult probation for a period of 5 years and let you out of the juvenile institution. If you haven't done well, see that facility down there on Wilbur Street? That's where you're going to go to complete your 20-year term service.
That's the adult facility?
Yeah. Right. It's up to you. It's your choice. You, therefore, one of the problems that we have with 17-year-olds who come into the juvenile system and the institution is that because they know that at age 19 or age 20, the system's done with them, they can flat time their detention, even though they've got this institution and they've got these programs that can that they can work with and work on solving their problems, and some do and are solved, many of them. And the youth counselors who work in the institution will come in and say, you know, we get a 17.5-year-old, 18-year-old in the system, and he sees that he can get out of here without working on his issues. He just flat times it and doesn't work on his issues. And they don't have this incentive to change. Well, I think that we can build some incentive by placing the burden of accountability on the kid, at the same time speeding up the process so it's at least no longer than the adult process.
Christine, can you critique Mark Wood's suggestions?
Well, I think, you know, the clear decisions on either keeping the kid in or sending the kid over to the adult facility, you know, I agree with that. There should be a way to do that expeditiously. And then some kind of a median ground where kids who are right in the middle, who have some potential, but it hasn't been tested, we don't know what's going to happen with them, a place for them to be tested. And I completely agree with extending the period of the court's jurisdiction over these kids so that it doesn't end at age 20. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition.
Would you begin with a grand jury and a trial of the act, regardless of the age of the offender?
I don't know. I don't even know enough about what the consequences of that would be on the kid's legal rights. So, you know, I don't know.
My principle is he gets all of his adult rights. I mean, right now he doesn't have the adult right to a speedy trial because mm-hmm. of the juvenile system. I mean, that's just essentially ignored because we're doing this more important issue. Should be treated as an adult, as a minor. But he would have the full all of the adult rights, plus we would build try to build confidentiality into the system. In other words, it would be a trial. The minor could have a public trial if he wanted, but it would be his discretion. Whereas now, you know, the person has a right to a public trial, and we just take care of it. But at least the issue would get resolved.
Under those
it
circumstances?
It would, unless the kid decided to waive his right to a speedy trial. And if that were to drag on, because I know there are adults that do that and end up not being tried for quite a long period of time.
I would respond to that as I think the public and the state who represents the public has a right, has a due process right to resolve these serious crimes, maybe not in 120 days, but at least in an expeditious manner. And I think that that's getting tromped on by the current system. And that affects society, who still wants to have this issue resolved, mm-hmm. and also the particularly the victims who have a right to be able to go on with their lives, to have this behind them, to have something done, whether the kid's acquitted or whether he's convicted. And to know what's going to happen to them within a reasonable period of time, so they can go about their lives. I think that's fair to them.
And I would assume also that within a reasonable period of time, the offender knows what the consequences are and can begin to follow the path of those consequences, treatment or hard time or whatever the state's offering.
Yeah, I think it's very hard on these juvenile offenders to sit mm-hmm. and sit and sit, and whether or not they had treatment. And I don't disagree with Christine's point that money should be provided to at least allow some type of, allow them to work on their issues during this period of time. But, they just fester. It doesn't do them any good. They're just in limbo until the system pronounces what's going to happen to the kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's not good either. It's not good for society. It's not good for the kid. The kid loses time, very important time as an adolescent, when he is more changeable and can be affecting positive change, but he's not working on those things.
Christine Smith, last thoughts on this issue.
I would just adopt Mark's suggestion that the law be changed to give the courts more flexibility to deal with juveniles. They've certainly, we know a lot more about kids than we've ever known in the past. But the laws as they're written are just too restrictive. And I think we need to follow the lead of some other states that are trying alternatives to either waiving or keeping kids in until only age 20. And I would suggest that our legislature seriously look at other laws and see if they could be adapted to Alaska.
Last thought, Mark Wood?
Yeah. Well, I agree. I think the legislature, in the last few years, we've had waiver bills, automatic waiver bills, where if a minor commits a certain type of crime at age 16, automatically he goes to the adult system just because of the commission of the crime. And I don't know if that's I don't think that's a solution, but the legislature's never acted on that. And one of the reasons legislature's never acted on that is that these serious waiver cases have turned out on the right side of the public. And I think that's one of the things that's one of the political things mm-hmm. that's going on, is that the Court of Appeals and the Superior Court judges recognize that if they do just decide to treat one of these serious offenders as a juvenile, that's going to bring out public wrath, and there will be a untoward change in the system as opposed to a well thought out one. I think that we need to take some time and work on the system now, and make some intelligent decisions and do some planning and decide how we want to treat juvenile offenders and who has the burden of their rehabilitation. And it's my opinion that the juvenile should have the burden of his rehabilitation rather than society.
But they can't do it without resources.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
Assistant District Attorney Mark Wood, Assistant Public Defender Christine Smith, thank you very much for this last hour. We've been talking about the juvenile system, the juvenile waiver system, juveniles who commit violent crimes. Next week on Sunday at noon, I'll be talking to Creek poet, American Indian poet, Joy Harjo. I hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, this is Susan McInnes for Sunday at Noon and KUAC-FM. Have a good Sunday.